شینی بل میسرود رشاندن خوینا خوی پاک نساندن دیرود بگرو گری لایقا بشیه پگه دستانه دستی هم دو قهرمانی درود گتلری کاته کشینی بل میسرود رشاندن خوینا خوی پاک نساندن دیرود بگرو گری لایقا بشیه پگه بشیه پگه چن از مرا دیگر وقت را دکمه عده کردوس همی وکشرا دلگل دا کام هوالا به سر و کسر داری خبیجیه بگه دار ندچن از مرا دیگر وقت را دکمه عده کردوس همی وکشرا دلگل دا کام هوالا سر و خسر داری و خبیجیه پگه بیجیه پگه شی بو آزادی دبی برفتان شینه بگلو گری لای خبیجیه پگه
دنگ کلشی تدی سا چالده هجینه ولد نه آزاد ببو مجیان نجینه شی بو آزادی دبی برفتان شینه بگلو گری لای خبیجیه پگه.
Thank you very much for your wonderful presentation. I learned so much. Just, I would like if you can explain or explain something about the fundamental role of second agency as a founder of PKK with Ocalan. She was being shot in France some years ago, and the French authorities, they just put under the carpet. Would you please, because it's a woman, she's a remarkable woman, and she was also,
yes,
she had all of these.
Yeah.
Maybe repeat the question.
Yeah. So she's asking about Sekine Jansız, who's one of the co-founders of the PKK. She's one of the first women of the PKK. So Sekine Jansız was murdered on January 9th, 2013, along with Fidan Doğan and Leyla Şahinemez in Paris. So this did not happen in Kurdistan, this happened in Paris. Immediately after the peace process between the PKK and the Turkish state was announced, Sakine Jansız, for many reasons, had a very symbolic and important meaning for the Kurdish women's movement, because she was one of the women who led the prison uprisings in the 1980s, at a time when, after the military coup, thousands of left-wing activists, Kurdish and Turkish and all kinds of people were imprisoned. She actually led a prison uprising, and she was sexually abused also in prison. Her breasts were mutilated when she faced torture by the authorities in prison. And later on she said, as a militant of a just cause, I was afraid to say, I was afraid, I was ashamed to complain, because I'm a militant of a just cause. So she's a very important woman in Kurdish women's history, in Kurdish history in general. And she was killed in Paris. And the French authorities to this day yet have to tell the world what they knew exactly about what is going on. Because later on tapes were leaked that suggested that the Turkish Secret Service was behind this. because by explicitly targeting three women, Fidan Doğan was an important activist in terms of diplomacy in Europe. Leyla Şahilemez was an activist of the Kurdish youth movement. By targeting three women like this, this is a very ideological target. The logic behind that was to weaken the morale of the movement. But actually, after the killing of these three women, the Kurdish women's movement became even stronger in order to make sure that these women did not die in vain. So for me, it was very emotional when I went to Rojava and I saw that now, after the state tried to kill these women, especially in the body of Sakine Cansız, you can read so many chapters of Kurdish history of resistance. Now she's on the walls of the places in women's academies where women now educate themselves and become leaders in their society. So in that sense, their legacy continues. In that sense, it is still up to us here in Europe to demand from the French authorities a thorough investigation of what happened in Paris. What did the French state know exactly? Why is this murder still not solved? The murderer has been captured, but nobody is talking about who gave him the order. It's not important who killed these three women. It's more important to see why they killed them and who gave them the order. It's not important the bullet. It's who made you use that bullet. So this is something that we must put pressure on the French authorities. So thank you very much for your question. But as we can see, she's still continuing the spirit of Rojava. And many women, after that, like many new babies that have been born, have been named after her, as well as the other two women that were killed, also in Rojava. Yes.
Thanks. Extremely interesting talk. I'd like to ask two questions. First, it sounds like there has been a huge transformation going on, maybe quite in a short period of time. And especially I'm interested in the transformation in people's mind, in their like in their sense of like what is their role in the community and so on. Mm-hmm. So how did it happen? What initiated the change of the transformation and what inspired it and mm-hmm. could it happen here? Mm-hmm. And the second question about the you mentioned the LGBT community, could you a little bit like describe more the role of maybe transgender people, because it sounds also like there is quite like a strong like women's identity in like and, like these groups based on the women identity mm-hmm. also. Mm-hmm. Like what about like
yeah.
not women at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Thanks. So regarding the first question, I mean this is still a process. So when you go to Rojava, it's not that everyone is not actively involved in all elements of life. Like we should never like romanticize what's happening, because the reality is these people face brutalities, war, violence, poverty, and so on. So some people just don't want to participate in anything. Or some people are, I mean, the ideas like class, for example, do not exist the way they do here, because many of the richer people never lived in Rojava anyway, because it was always the poorest place. But there are still class divisions. So some people were like, I'm rich, what do I care about cooperatives? Right? So these kinds of things, when you try to establish a new system, if you don't want to be authoritarian, you have to be careful and sensitive towards ethnic conflicts, class conflicts, and so on. So this is very difficult. But how people were approaching things is first to just go literally to all households, knock on every single door and say, hey, we're forming communes, if you want to join. Or people were slowly seeing that things were taking shape and then became more confident. And then they sent their children, sent their own families, went themselves to the academies. Like there's social sciences academies, there's women's academies, there's culture academies, literacy, sports, everything, economy academies. So basically the approach was to, first of all, try to reach everyone, tell everyone this is what's happening, this is what we want to do, let's organize in the form of a commune, and then create councils, and then and so on and so forth. So now, especially in the Kurdish regions, this is very much developed, because this has been a political project that has been ongoing, but now the priority of the people is to gain confidence and trust between different communities. Like some Arabs, for example, say, how can I trust them? Maybe they want to expel me now. Because the regime actually in the 60s settled Arabs in the Jazeera region in order to cause conflict between Arabs and Kurds, where there was no conflict before. So in that sense, now some Kurds also say, so now the Arabs should leave because this is our territory. So there are obviously ethnic conflicts, and they overlap a lot of times with property, because the land is owned by Arabs that the Kurds regard as their lands. So it's like, how do you create socially just institutions without causing more conflict? So in that sense, people now understand themselves as subjects rather than objects of a state. I think this is something that I have very clearly seen. When you talk to the people, they know everything. Like, they know exactly how the system works. They know exactly where the money goes. They know exactly who's in charge of what. They know exactly where they can go to complain. So this level of awareness, of consciousness, this was for me very remarkable, because sometimes I feel lost. Like, I'm like, how... I don't even know how to like exercise my right to exist. Whereas the people in Rojava are now trying to articulate themselves as actors, as agents, as subjects, rather than being administered. They're now the people who self-determine, but not in the form of like a state, but as something different. So maybe this is a very complicated question that I cannot answer in a quick time. But when it comes to the LGBT question, obviously this is very important, because if you truly want to have a democratic, just society, you cannot create new identities or like reinforce certain identities at the expense of others. But for the LGBT community in Kurdistan, it's very, very difficult to organize. I can give you one example of one young man who had, I had read an interview. He moved from the Kurdish regions, he's a gay man who went to the Kurdish regions, to Istanbul, because he felt in the anonymous big city atmosphere of Istanbul, it's more liberal, it's more relaxed, I can like organize in LGBT circles. He went there, and there he was discriminated because he's Kurdish. So we laugh, but actually it's not funny at all, because he has no place. He does not know where to organize. So in that sense, for the Kurdish women's movement, for example, who's trying to be an ally, a place where LGBT community can organize themselves, they do not want to talk on behalf of the LGBT community. The LGBT community, first of all, is forming itself. We cannot say it's like a community yet. It is still shaping itself, because it's so difficult for people to come out. It's so difficult for people in such places to openly be in with their sexual identity, their gender identities. So in that sense, it's hard. Like for me, for example, if you ask me, I don't know what I can do, because I don't want to talk on behalf of anyone. I want to be supportive, but how can I be supportive if the people have not, unfortunately, due to the conditions, not been able to? But there's hope in the sense that, I mean, the HDP, the People's Democratic Party, which is now in the Turkish parliament, is one of the two only parties in Turkey that have signed a thing that says we respect and we fully support LGBT rights. In the local elections, there were LGBT candidates. There was a trans woman, for example, in Istanbul who was a candidate. So this is great. This is very important. It demands a lot of courage. But in that sense, like, it's really difficult. So when we say women's liberation, we categorize women not as like one essentialist category, rather than that as like a sociological phenomenon. For example, patriarchy has always destroyed that which it perceives as the weak, as the feminine, as the not male, as the not masculine, and so on. So patriarchy is actually the one that is reinforcing these binaries. So in a place where it's explicitly targeting women because they're women, where it's explicitly using sexual violence as a tool of war, women have to organize themselves as women. But we may have to make sure that we do not do that at the expense of people who may be seen as women by others, but who do not identify as such. So in that sense, LGBT issues are very important, but at the moment it's really difficult for the people to organize themselves. It's difficult for us to articulate positive ways of being allies without speaking on behalf of people. But otherwise, the Kurdish women's movement is fully supportive of LGBT rights. It has to be. And this is also something, hopefully, that we will see in Rojava in the future. Because, I mean, when we say freedom, when we say democracy, obviously this has to include everyone. But people who identify as LGBT in Kurdistan, they have so many different identities that they need to battle. But also there's some heavy LGBT, for example, or Keskesor, which are two prominent LGBT organizations that identify as Kurdish also. They also actively organize for Rojava. They actively denounce the state's denial of the Armenian genocide. So it's interesting that their LGBT identity comes with all of these political identities as well. So in a way, it's very radical, but it has to become stronger, and hopefully it can.
You mentioned the collectives and the cooperatives and the farms. So I would be interested to know about the state of self-sufficiency and economic autonomy within the region, because that's also linked to the ecological side. So is there a clear path and clear this sort of a... Do you have plans for autonomous, self-sufficient farming and so forth for each area?
Mm-hmm.
And how participatory is it? Do people participate, or are they encouraged to participate in the basic production?
Mm-hmm.
On what level?
Okay, thank you.
And then there was a second one.
What is the relation of Rojava now to the United Nations?
United Nations.
Okay, partly related to what he said. I would like to ask about the economic aspect of the women's liberation. Like, so you are dismantling patriarchy, so you must dismantle its like economic base, like gender, education, and labor. So how is the economy being organized? How is production being organized? And how do most people, especially women, make a living in Rojava?
I was thinking about there are Finnish soldiers training Kurdish fighters in Kurdistan, in the Kurdish areas. Do you have any knowledge of the work there? And is it somehow connected to the self-defense forces you talked about? And what is the Kurdish viewpoint for these Finnish trainers, other soldiers abroad training the fighters there?
Is this in Iraq or Kurdistan?
Yeah,
so maybe I can take the first and the second questions on the economies together. Yeah. So basically, I put on the map again to illustrate. Actually, Jizya has been always considered the breadbasket of Syria. So this is Jizya. Actually, is Arabic and means island because it's the most fertile area of Syria. Kobani is also usually like wheat and things like that. Afrin is, as you can see, is closer to the Mediterranean. It has a different climate there. You have more vegetables, olives, fruits, and things like that. Whereas this part is more grain-based. So the Syrian state, since the 60s, there is a very interesting secret service report of the Ba'ath Party regarding economic policies in the Jizira region. They encouraged only certain kinds of grains to be planted and harvested there. So basically, this was serving as the breadbasket of Syria. The products were taken, processed in the other parts, and then sold back to the people. So it was like an internal colony. In that sense, people now experiment about what other kinds of goods they can produce. Because now the territory has been conditioned only for certain wheats, let's say. But actually now they realize the regime was lying. We can also plant this and this and this and that. So now people are experimenting with that. And as I've said, 40% was in the Jizira region here, was owned by the state. And now this is being given back to the people. And so, as I've said, this often overlaps with ethnic conflicts. Because sometimes people ask, is land being expropriated from the rich people? No, it's not. Because many of the rich people who own land are either important tribal leaders who are Arabs. And this, if you do that, you have all the Arabs against you. So this is obviously not a solution. But now the places that the administration has distributed to the people and is still doing, actually it suffices for the people. Now that these two places are connected, the Jizya region can give a lot of stuff to Kobani because Kobani is completely destroyed. So the fact actually that there's a full embargo on Rojava promoted self-sufficiency. It actually encouraged creativity. It now actually, I asked once, like, I don't see beggars really in Rojava. And they said people don't usually starve in Rojava, which is very, very remarkable considering we talk about Syria. Does not mean everyone is equal in terms of how their economic situation is, but it is a lot better than the rest of Syria. So, but Afrin is under a very difficult position, but it's very fertile and very productive. So economically, it is actually quite self-sufficient. But there's a mixed, very, very mixed economic system. Because one, we have a war, we have an embargo, you have an economy of survival, basically, where you do not have an adequate policy. So one policy is to not have private investors come and just do whatever they want. For example, a lot of people now have an eye on Kobani because they want to be the ones to rebuild Kobani, but people don't accept that. So the Council of Kobani said, no, we do not invite people to come and just build huge houses for everyone. We want this to be a collective process. So this is basically what is happening. So ethnic problems, class issues, the war, trauma, poverty is all like coming together, which makes it difficult to have like an economic policy in that sense. But people are managing, and hopefully they, I mean, the biggest, for me, the biggest fear that I have about whether or not Rojava will succeed is how can they protect it from capitalist corruption, basically. This will be a big, very, very important thing that people in Europe, for example, can contribute. Without international solidarity, it will be difficult to rebuild a place like Kobani. So these kinds of things are things that people in Europe can do, for example. Like, but, I mean, I don't have that study to. I hope this kind of gave... but when it comes to like making a living, the life continues because you... It's not like now there's factories where people work. It's not like the economy has completely changed. People still have their shops. People still have their lands. It continues. But people, the administration is trying to make it as just as possible by the stuff that is now, that was previously owned by the state, by distributing that, and by also democratizing the landowners, by making them integral to the communal system. The question about United Nations, I can answer very briefly. There is... none. There is no relationship between Rojava and the United Nations, as far as I know. No institution in the world has recognized Rojava as an entity. Federalism has been declared just a couple of weeks ago. Everyone from the Assad regime to the Americans to the Turkish state to Iraqi Kurdistan, everyone has said we do not... Sorry, I took back Iraqi Kurdistan. They actually said something in support of that. But nobody recognizes anything political about Rojava, except for the military element. About the last question, I'm not aware of the Finnish soldier in Rojava. So maybe this is the case in Iraqi Kurdistan, because actually also German troops, American troops have gone to America, to Iraqi Kurdistan to train people there. And the system, the political system in Iraqi Kurdistan is very different from the one in Rojava. So maybe we can talk about that. People are getting out some. We'll talk about that later. Thank you for your questions.
hesap burada. Serin meşber belinde. YPG hesap burada. Serin meşber belinde.
From the lecture with Dila Direk and we, that is Juho and Ina from Uchtesser Rojavan Polestar, we are going to interview Dila with a few more questions. And Dila, you talked a lot about the women's liberation struggle, and could you maybe, we were thinking it would be interesting to hear a bit how it all started.
So basically, although today everyone has seen the struggle of Kurdish women with the resistance that they have displayed against the so-called Islamic State, actually, Kurdish women's resistance has a decades-old, if not century-old, legacy. So if today women are fighting against an explicitly feminicidal system like the Islamic State, which is using rape and sexual violence as a tool of war, it's because they have long been organizing in different spheres, including armed struggle. However, so we can say that in all kinds of Kurdish political projects, women have always played a very important role. But it was with the foundation of the PKK, we can say, the Kurdistan Workers' Party, that it has become an institutionalized aim of the struggle, not just a side issue such as women will also be free in a free Kurdistan once the nation is liberated, but rather it was made a central goal. This is what distinguished the PKK from other Kurdish political parties at the time until today. So in that sense, when women were also among the people who founded this party, the women's liberation element has always been on the agenda, but only after the paradigm shift in the after 2005, we can say, but earlier even in the 2000s, this has become an explicit goal. But even in the 90s, encouraged by Abdullah Öcalan, women in the PKK formed the Autonomous Women's Army. Today it is called Yeşil Astar, they also called their women's party within the PKK, which is called PASHK, the Party of Free Women of Kurdistan. So in that sense, this autonomous organization actually has a longer history. But it was first only in the guerrilla, in the mountain sphere, basically. It's kind of difficult, of course, even in these conditions, to organize women there, but it is easier than to do that in a society. Because in the society, you have a civil life, you have all kinds of different issues that women face, where they're not militants. So in that sense, carrying these ideals to the community was actually a very difficult task. But even in the guerrilla sphere, the women faced immense obstacles, opposition from men who did not want to accept that women would be equal to them. Many of the men who joined the PKK's armed struggle in the 90s, from especially the rural areas, they never interacted with women on an equal level. They always regarded them as their wives, as their sisters or mothers. So it was very radical for them to have to acknowledge that women are equal to them. And we still see today in Kurdistan the same mentality continue. So although this political project has established a political sphere in which no longer we have to discuss issues like gender equality, it is a principle that people have to abide to. It does not mean that it is reflected necessarily in the society. So making these ideals of women's liberation get roots in the society, this is the difficult task. But at the moment, in the political parties like the People's Democratic Party, in the revolution Rojava, in the mountainous spheres, but also on the societal level in Turkey as well, through social initiatives that women have taken, pioneered by, of course, the role of, you know, strong women has been very important in that, and the fact that women are defending the people, this has been an eye-opener for many men who see that women can also defend men and their families. All of these elements combined have led to a very strong and organized women's movement. So it is both in the political sphere, in the military sphere, in the social, cultural sphere, that a slow mentality change is occurring. It is slow, but it is nevertheless radical.
You said there was some kind of a turning point in 2005. Mm-hmm. What happened then?
In 2005, this is when democratic confederalism was declared in the Nevruz celebrations in Diyarbakir. This was Abdullah Öcalan's message about now articulating a struggle not for a Kurdish nation state, but for democratic confederalism based on women's liberation, ecology, and grassroots democracy. So this is when women's liberation explicitly began to be one of the main pillars of the struggle.
But as you said, the women had been organizing autonomously for almost a decade before that, right?
Yes, yes, exactly. But in that time, it was more in the guerrilla sphere, in the armed sphere. But after 2005, this became bigger in the societal, in the communal level, in civil society, and in legal political spheres.
Okay. And in practice, how do women make living in Rojava?
The economy of Rojava, as we have also previously talked about in the lecture, is a very mixed economy. It is. We cannot say that everything has changed. We cannot say that all material conditions have changed, that the means of production have changed. No, it is a economy of war, of survival, under an embargo. So in that sense, many traditional economies continue. Gift economies continue. Black markets continue. I mean, we're talking about a war. So, but the fact that the administration now encourages women to become economically independent is very important, because just simply political emancipation without any change in the material conditions of women, on the economic conditions of women, will not genuinely liberate them. Because, I mean, one of the biggest problems of women everywhere in the world is that it is due to economic injustices, economic conditions, that they are forced to remain with, for example, a domestically abusive husband, an oppressive family, that they cannot learn new skills, educate themselves, that they cannot live the life they want because of economic conditions. So in that sense, many traditional jobs, as I said, continue. Many women also don't work, but now they more and more they're engaging in the community organizing. More and more women are organizing themselves with their communes in the form of cooperatives. They harvest their own products. They sell their own products. There is now also textile, autonomous textile cooperatives of women. So all of the places where women can go, if they, for example, want to get a divorce or they want to free themselves of an abusive partner, they always provide them with economic initiatives, always teach them skills with which they can economically emancipate themselves. So this is very important because, for example, the concept of women's shelters today is quite problematic because it only physically protects the woman for a short while, but then she has to go again and she's just being dropped into the water once again. But when you give the woman means to educate herself, to gain skills, to make her own living, this is very important. But like on the daily life, still, there's many women who are functioning as teachers, as doctors, women who are also shopkeepers, but not many. I mean, the traditional division of, you know, of labor in terms of gender still continues in many elements. But now the administration is trying to promote women to take up every kind of job that they want. So, I mean, the fact that they are now security officers, that they're fighters, this is perhaps the biggest taboo that has been broken. So in that sense, once people see that women are capable of defending their hometowns, they believe, okay, women can probably do anything. But for women who lack access to education, who don't even know how to read and write, this is quite difficult. Because first of all, you have to give women the same level. They first have to understand, you know, basic things before they can have the confidence to organize themselves. So this is what I can quickly say about that.
Now that you mentioned, could you tell a bit about the education system in Rojava? What's going on there?
Yes, the educational system of Rojava is actually very exciting and very interesting. Because above all, the people in Rojava want to initiate a mental revolution. This means that rather than understanding themselves as objects of a state, as objects of a bureaucratic elite, they want to become agents, self-determining actors. So this, above all, requires consciousness, political consciousness and literacy. So the academies play a crucial role in Rojava. So there's still the official schools and everything, but now the people have articulated new curricula, new educational schedules. Now, for example, for primary education and, you know, elementary, middle school, high school kind of thing, this is all still being discussed and figured out. So now they're still translating and working on the material. So it's a slow process because it's being discussed and then tried and experimented with. But for example, now people are encouraged, children are encouraged to learn all of the three dominant languages there, Kurdish, Arabic and Aramaic. And they're not called foreign language, but the language of the neighboring community. This is in order to say this is not a foreign language, this is also a language of your community. And in order to get along, we should all speak these languages, or at least know some of it. So the academies, there's, for example, economy academies, social science academies, women's academies that are autonomous, culture academies, and many other things like that, arts. So the aim of these academies is to be something outside of formal education. So basically, people who go to these academies usually stay there for a month, maybe longer, depends on what they want to do. They get education, but they also have a communal living. So with the people that you have the education with, you live together, you cook together, you clean together, you wake up together, and you become both student as well as teacher. So I want to give the example of the Mesopotamia Academy of Social Sciences. It was formed in, if I'm not mistaken, September 2014 in Kamishlo. And there, they want to radically challenge how we understand the social sciences today, because the social sciences, especially sociology, today often, especially in advanced capitalist countries, perpetuates different forms of oppression, like sexism, racism, and so on. So the logic of this academy was to fundamentally rethink social sciences. it's 1 year long, the term. Like, after 1 year, you kind of, like, graduate. So the first term, it's like three trimesters. The first term is introduction to history and sociology. The second term, but rather than, like, memorizing theories, it's about why is it important to read history? Why is it important to do sociology? Second term is more like a deepening. And the third term is basically the students are given the task of writing something like a thesis or a project in which they identify a social problem and then they solve it. So this can be a problem in their community that they then decide to solve. And then, so the goal is not to have like an official degree, because no world, no state, no place in the world will recognize that you graduated from that academy. But it's about generating, producing conscious and active individuals. So it's not an education in the sense that they bombard you with theories, but it's discussion. So for me, I also participated in some of their lectures. It was very interesting to see that people do not refer to each other as teacher and student. Everyone calls each other Hebal, which means something like friend or comrade. So one day you can be a teacher, the next day you can be sitting there and be the student. But it's all a dialogue. They're trying to create non-hierarchical relationships. They try to really socialize, I guess, maybe, or communalize the education by decentralizing it, by making it accessible to everyone. Like in the Women's Academy, where I spent 1 week in Ramallah, for example, one class was about ecology. So in a place where you have no means, very little education about what is ecology, how do you even talk to people who have never heard about this before? So the person who was giving that class, she asked the women in the room, most of them were elderly women who were working in the women's houses and in the tribunals and so on. She was asking them, what do you think about ecology? What does ecology mean to you? And then everyone was giving their personal perspective on that. So it's more about discussion. It's more about communicating the principles on which this revolution is founded, because actually it is not very rigid theories. It's actually very basic things, three basic things: ecology, grassroots democracy, women's liberation. These are actually very, very basic things. This is not something that you have to sign to. This is not like a rigid ideology in that sense. It is very strict on these three principles, but this is something that can actually bring together a wide range of people. And in this sense, it is also about democratizing education. So there is now various discussions about how to accommodate like different languages, how will this be in the future, what will the role be of the academies, and then parallel to that, like the formal educational system, because they still, of course, they want to have some kind of educational system where the children go on a daily basis. But academies are more like for adults. It's like an alternative kind of education. So these things are things that will be discussed in the future. But similar things are also happening inside Turkey and also in other parts. One very important element is genealogy. Genealogy means, gen is woman in Kurdish. And genealogy is the paradigm towards sciences that the Kurdish women's movement is proposing. To re-articulate history, to reread it, reinterpret it from a women's perspective. So it's not like a gender studies, it's rather how can we decolonize methodologies of social sciences? How can we get rid of patriarchy when even the methodology of the modern sciences is based on the thinking of very patriarchal mentalities? So in that sense, very exciting things are going on. The academies play a very crucial role. So it's not about making people think alike. It's about establishing a culture of democracy. It's about establishing the ability to be able to criticize, because criticism and self-criticism are also very important mechanisms in the educational process. For example, after each lecture, let's say, the teacher criticizes themselves and also asks the students to criticize them. So criticizing the teacher is important, and the teacher has to accept that and then criticize themselves also. So in that sense, these issues are very, very important, because we're talking about changing mentalities. All these oppressive mechanisms cannot establish themselves if they hadn't established themselves in our minds first, such as sexism. Before the act of rape, there must be a sexist mentality first, or a patriarchal rapist mentality before that act can be committed. So this is basically what Rojava is trying to do, and yeah, hopefully it can succeed.
How is it at the moment with primary school, for example, for the children in mm-hmm. Rojava? You say now you talk about academies, but
mm-hmm.
Parallelly to it, there's the other education mm-hmm. system, or how does it work?
So basically, the regime schools, they still exist across Syria,
mm.
and Rojava less and less. The problem is that many of the people who worked as teachers, they are paid by the regime still, but the regime stopped paying them in the last couple of years. But some of them are still being paid by the regime. So it's difficult because the regime does this strategically in order to create tensions and conflict. So what the administration has decided to do, as far as I'm concerned, maybe things have changed, is to convince these teachers who work for the regime to work for them. For example, a math teacher is not, it's not, it doesn't matter who this math teacher works for. Math is math. 1 + 1 is always 2. So, and many of the people have actually decided to work for them, for the new administration instead. But they obviously cannot pay the way the regime does. And most of the people in Rojava work on a voluntary basis anyway. So this is the thing. The new administration, when I was still there, like last year, they had come up with like a educational system up to year 3, and they were working on the rest. So they were trying to, especially when it comes to classes like history, sociology, and things like that, they really have to radically rewrite things because the nationalist, chauvinistic ideology of the regime was obviously distorting history. So in that sense, it's a collective process. A lot of Arab students and teachers and Christian teachers are involved in the process as well. What kind of educational system do we want for Rojava? This is a very central question, but it is still being discussed. So these schools, they continue, like formal education. Some of the teachers are being paid by the regime. They receive their salaries from the regime, but now the regime has stopped paying most of them. So now some of these teachers work for them instead. So some of the buildings are still the same buildings, some are new buildings. So it's like really difficult. I cannot give a definite answer because it's really, really messy. But in places like Kobani, for example, there's absolutely no regime presence. So everything is being done by the people autonomously. So in there, for example, they have to accommodate so many children in one classroom, for example, because the whole city is destroyed and everyone is working on a voluntary basis. So in that sense, education will be a very important question for the future as well.
Okay. Yeah, and then we heard in your lecture or your speech before that about asylum, and that's a hot topic here in Europe, of course, mm-hmm. Because of the refugees coming, wanting to cross the borders, and you told that in Rojava, there everybody is welcome. Can you tell more about this asylum system?
Yes. So basically, in the social contract of the Rojava cantons, there is an explicit paragraph which states that every person has the right to seek asylum in Rojava, and that nobody can be thrown out of Rojava against their will. So nobody can be deported. So, I mean, it's interesting because usually states determine asylum rights, international systems do, but Rojava decides on their own. So it is disregarding any kinds of other regulations and says this is our autonomous sphere and everyone is welcome here. And this is especially important because actually people do go there. It's not like some kind of idealistic statement in the thought that nobody will ever come anyway. No, people actually do go. Actually, 100,000s of people have sought asylum in Rojava from the rest of Syria, but also from Iraq. I had mentioned that more than 10,000 Yazidi refugees were brought to Rojava when Daesh was attacked, and they decided to stay, even though they can actually go back. But they decided to stay, and so there is now the Nevros camp in Rojava, in Derik, right by the border between Iraq and Syria, where at the moment I think 6,000 people live, and it's completely administered by the people themselves. It's been built with the democratic administration of Rojava, but it was with the will of the people. So the democratic autonomy system is also being implemented there. So the refugee camp has built their communes. They actually have their committees. They actually have their educational system. They have their arts collectives and stuff. So it's really, really nice to see that, because these people have undergone a huge trauma. So in that sense, being welcomed with open arms has been a very important healing process for them. But also many Turkmen people, Arab people from different parts of both Iraq and Syria have come to Rojava. I have met some people who were refugees from like Raqqa and other places like that, like from homes, who have gone to Rojava. So in that sense, it is very, very important to see, especially considering the increasing rise of ethnic tensions, religious conflict, nationalism, racism between the different communities, that Rojava has a policy like that. And it's completely autonomous. It's a region that suffers itself under an embargo, because, I mean, usually European states, governments, usually tend to say, you know, our economy cannot sustain it. Well, Rojava's economy can also not sustain it. They're living under an embargo. They're suffocating under it. You know, there's the war. There is violence, but still they open these people. They open their arms for these people. And this is above all a political, it's an ideological statement to make. Welcoming people, saying this is also your home. This is actually very, very important. And this is actually showing people from the rest of Syria that the Rojava project is genuine. That this is actually a home that they have. That this is not a Kurdish-dominated region. This is a region that will be determining for the future of Syria. So in terms of gaining trust, this their policy on refugees actually is very helpful in that sense. In contrast to, for example, in Iraqi Kurdistan, there is increasingly hostile policies from Arab refugees from other parts of Iraq. So there is a big difference in there as well. It is still maybe more tolerant than other parts, but Rojava has a very different and explicitly open policy regarding that. And actually, this, if Rojava was supported, if Rojava had more like support, not from states, but like from the international people, you know, from grassroots communities, it could also help the situation in Europe. Because many people, I mean, people don't want to become refugees. People must realize that. People love their homes. Now their homes are destroyed, that's why they have to leave. But many people can actually stay in Rojava. So if there was, like, if the situation was safer, if the economic situation was better, people can actually stay there. They do not have to cross oceans to go elsewhere. And many people decide to stay. And so now the people in Rojava have also started campaigns to say, come back. Come back, it's safe here, you can stay here, we will take care of you. Yeah.
We have been talking now mostly about Rojava, but could you tell us what's happening in Bakur, in the southeast Turkey, where Turkish state is again attacking the Kurdish population in a really brutal way?
So after the elections, especially after the first elections in June 2015, which did not result in the way the Erdogan administration wanted it, and I explicitly say Erdogan administration because although he's the president, he functions as the dictator ruler, even though he's not the executive ruler, but it's still his party. He's supposed to be in a neutral position. So he has explicitly begun to launch an open war against the Kurdish population. Many human rights organizations have called this collective punishment. And actually, we can see that the fact that the HDP, the People's Democratic Party, has passed the 10% threshold, this had angered him so much, because this, in fact, denied him the supermajority rule that he needed to get his system across. So in that sense, what happened is that a brutal war was launched, resulting in hundreds of civilian massacres and casualties. In November 1st, the elections were repeated because, as I've said, the ruling party was not happy with the first results. And it's interesting because Europe was very complicit in this. there were leaked documents that suggest that the EU Commission on Human Rights did not publish a report on Turkey and waited until after the elections just to appease Turkey so that Turkey will take in refugees. So the EU is very well aware of the human rights abuses. And Germany, Angela Merkel actually visited Erdogan before that, and ever since we see an increasing criminalization of Kurdish activists in Germany and also complete media blackouts in Europe about what's happening in Turkey. So the Turkish army has used very similar methods to Islamic State. They have killed women, stripped them naked, photographed them, and spread them on social media. They have tied the corpses of killed people to tanks and dragged them through towns and filmed it. Like, these are not random people. These are soldiers. They tie dead bodies and drag them on the vehicles. They have made incredibly disgusting, murderous campaigns against the Kurdish population. The in Cizre, three basements were bombarded. In some, people were burned alive. People were killed while having breakfast. People are just randomly being shot on the street, but because of the curfews, nobody can go out. People cannot even bury their dead. Like, the dead bodies have to stay in the streets for 7 days. And one woman had to be stored in a refrigerator, her body, because of the curfew. So this is like a massacre after massacres happening in Turkey. And the EU is just watching it, because the EU has given 3 billion euros to Turkey to stop the refugee crisis. But the refugee crisis is there because of Turkey's policies, because of Turkey's policies in Syria and in Iraq, because for Turkey it is a bigger issue to have Kurds on the border than to have Islamic State on the border. Turkey is one of the primary causers of the refugee crisis, and what Europe is doing is basically indirectly helping the Islamic State continue. So indirectly contributing to the refugee crisis, indirectly contributing to the inferno in the Middle East. So in that sense, we cannot separate what's happening in Syria from what's happening in Turkey at the moment, and we must understand that the Turkey-EU relationships are helping Turkey murder Kurdish civilians at the moment, because it is another thing to fight against a guerrilla organization, which is also armed. It is a very different thing to attack and massacre civilians. The Kurdish forces, the guerrillas included, they do not attack civilians. There is the TAK, the Freedom Falcons of Kurdistan, which do attacks like explosions, but they also tend to target police and army positions. I'm not trying to justify what they do, but the ones that are considered the most terrorist, they have a more ethical stance on war conduct than the army, which is an official state, a EU candidate, and NATO partner. So this alone should shock people, but it doesn't. There is a complete media blackout, so I think people in their countries need to urge their media to state what is happening exactly in Turkey and why is EU complicit in that.
And how have the people living in these areas reacted to that? Is it right that they kind of declared whole area like autonomous Bakur?
Yes, so this was the fact that the state tried to collectively punish people was also one, because the people participated in democratic elections, and the HDP party in places like Cizre received more than 90% of the votes. This is one reason why the army is attacking these places. They also voted most for the HDP. But these are also places who now declare autonomy, because they say, okay, we participated in democratic elections and we're being punished for it now. If we cannot even do that, if our media is being silenced, if our political representatives, our mayors, our politicians, everyone can be imprisoned, if our newspapers are being closed, if our schools being closed, our legal representatives being shot, our children being murdered, then we do not have anything to do with the state. We declare our autonomy. And so this is what really, really upsets the Turkish state, that the Kurdish people dare to do something outside of the Turkish state. Because their fear is really, it is not about, like I said, they're more scared of Kurdish self-rule than they are from Islamic State. And there's enough evidence to suggest that there is Islamic State-Turkish collaboration anyway. But their stance on what's happening at the moment, the way the Turkish state is utilizing the coalition support against the Kurds, not against Daesh. The Islamic State has been bombarded maybe 2-3 times by the Turkish army, but thousands of times they have bombarded the Kurdish forces, so the priorities are clear. So in that sense, self-rule, self-administration, in the concept of democratic autonomy, is the biggest threat to the nation-state of Turkey.
Thank you for the talk. And
thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.